What the F is brought to you by listeners like you, thanks to our Patreon members, patreon.com/whattheif. Go there now and find out how you can become a member and get all kinds of cool rewards. And thank you for supporting our mission for science education and science fun. Welcome to What the If. Free will edition, where you will do my bidding. That's just a tease or a threat. Of the coming episode. Stay tuned. We'll be getting to that in just a moment. But first, ladies and gentlemen, we introduce Dr. Gabby Panicia.
Woot!
Woo!
Congratulations, Gabby. You achieved doctorship, doctorhood.
Yeah, I only had to fight like six snakes. It was
That's not bad. No formatting errors. This is our first majority PhD episode.
That's right.
Oh no, Phil, you're outnumbered.
That's true. In fact, we got to visit Gabby at the celebration for her PhD, and I do remember, Gabby, you said I need to get to work fast. So. Mm-hmm.
Because then we might as well go for the clean sweep.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's going to be a long way because I pretty much left off with my bar mitzvah. That was it. I've got a lot of training beyond to get to professorship. But I get to play the dumb guy, actually. As another thing, I got to meet Gabby's parents, which was phenomenal. And so a big shout out to your parents. And what were their names again, Gabby?
Joe and Cindy.
Joe and Cindy. It was wonderful to see you there. And they're big fans of the show, so we want to give our gratitude out to them. And one of the things your mom said was that she enjoyed that she didn't use these words, but she basically said she enjoyed that I, Philip, get to represent all the dumb people.
Yeah. My mom
I enjoy that role. Yeah,
about herself just listening to the show. She's like, when's somebody going to ask this like one question that I want to know? Which is why she's always like Phil as a host, because you like finally ask like the question that apparently she always has in her head.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's an important skill.
Good. Yeah. 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 I appreciate that. So that was great. So congratulations, Gabby. Also, just pull your microphone a little closer there if you can. Was there anything in the, you think you were telling me that you had to do, so you did like a talk, which I think is called a defense in front of an audience. Is that right?
Yeah.
A public audience. And there were some people that threw questions at you there, or was that in the other defense?
There's both. So there's a public defense, which has, you know, people from the university can, like basically anybody can come. Then, you know, I take questions from the audience, and then there's a private defense where I take questions from my committee only. Mm-hmm. And they'll ask me questions about stuff that's in my written thesis as well. So it's not just about the presentation, it's about the written thesis, like the whole of my time as a PhD student. And there's also an external examiner, which is sort of like, you know, we talk about peer review in science for like articles, but you also get peer review for becoming a scientist at all, which is that they sort of invite another scientist from another university to kind of like grill you about your science. Ooh. And like defend your reasoning.
An outside agitator.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
basically.
That's right.
Yeah, that's exactly who they invite.
Who was yours? So did you get to pick?
I did. It was sort of like a process with my PI where it was mostly like, you know, we should choose somebody in the city who's well-versed in like, you know, virology. We should choose one of the virologists, basically. I got a little grilled on like just like basic science questions. But like when you say basic science questions, it's like extremely, extremely specific parts of the interferon response, which I thought I'd avoid needing to know extremely specifically, because the entire crux of my thesis was that the thing that I found was interferon independent. And so when I got a lot of these like very specific questions, I'm like, God, no, I don't know the two transcription factors produced only as a result of interferon treatment. Like, no, I don't remember that. Wow. I remember that there are some. I remember some of the transcription factors that go up higher that are already there. I don't remember the unique two. So it was like it was definitely a moment for me, because I was like, oh God, maybe I shouldn't be getting this PhD. Because it was just like, and then once they started asking me about like my protein, then I like could talk about it forever. I was like, oh yeah, this part I know, because I've studied like this one protein for like 2 years.
Well, Heisenberg, of the uncertainty principle fame, failed his PhD defense the first time because his external examiner asked him to derive how a telescope works, which is a very basic physics one thing, and he couldn't remember how to do it. So he had to do the whole defense again. He was a little angry about that.
Truly, so that would have been me.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, there's some stuff I don't remember because I can Google it.
Yeah, that's right.
It never sticks.
That would have been a great answer. Let me Google that. So Heisenberg's response to the question was, I am uncertain.
Yeah, I just don't know. I guess. And actually, to say there's some irony here in that you actually derive the uncertainty principle with the same math as the telescope derivation, too.
So, no way.
Funny. Yeah, so
that's a delightful thematic string.
Yeah.
That's funny. Oh, we'll have to do a show on the uncertainty principle at some point. It'll be kind of
fun. I'm not sure.
Yeah. No, yeah, actually, I'm not sure. I don't know if I have the will to do it. Speaking of which, and so we've not mentioned, this is you, the other person here with us, our other co-host, of course, is currently going by the name this week of Low on Toner.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Low on Toner, but yeah.
Dr. Low on Toner.
Important.
AKA Matt Stanley from New York University. How are you? Now, is graduation is coming up? Is
that right? Graduation is coming up in 10 days, I think. So classes are ending right now, and then next week is finals.
All right. Do you do anything in the ceremony of any?
Not this year, no.
No. No karate demonstrations.
Well, no planned karate demonstrations. Sometimes they spontaneously occur. Yeah,
it's true. It's true. We have a quick hit from the mailbag. Oh my goodness! And it's still the bluegrass music. It is another missive, another cable, another message from Lars in Sweden checking in. Lars numbers his emails, by the way, and this was, I believe, he called number 11 that he has sent to us. Thank you, Lars. And Lars also did send, because I had mentioned last week that this music, as wonderful as the What the If players are in their skill at playing this bluegrass, I think that's bluegrass music, it wasn't particularly Swedish. So that maybe Lars needed his own theme. And Lars has actually sent in some options, but they were from Spotify, which are copyright, so I'm not sure if I can use those. But I'm going to work on, we'll work on finding some music for Lars, and we thank you, Lars, for sending that in. Just a quick hit from his emails are often very long and fanciful and insightful, so I'm not able to provide all of them, but I wanted to mention, Lars, that we do read them, and we thank you for that. Here's just a little excerpt from this week's. He says he has some feedback on our episode from last time, and that was the one Gabby, you and I did. Called Screaming for Love, and that was about a little fish that, unbelievably tiny fish, that makes a sound that is extraordinarily loud for anything, let alone the size of this tiny fish. And so Lars asks, how did it evolve into that ability? As far as I know, there are no other fishes that produce sound underwater.
Mm.
That's interesting.
Interestingly, he is incorrect. There are many fish that do that.
Oh. Okay.
Namely, the black drum fish, which also produces a very loud sound, but it is a much bigger fish.
Interesting.
So, fish. Yeah.
So I actually don't know the method for black drum fish, with exactly how they generate the sound. It's probably also something related to their swim bladder, but maybe not the unique, like, rib flexing mechanism that the other fish uses.
Yeah.
I realized only at the end of that episode that I had that I'd done my math very wrong because I forgot decibels are exponential. They're not linear.
Mm-hmm. Ooh.
So trying to figure out how many times bigger the fish we are than the fish.
Right.
Like there's an extra layer of calculus that I'd have to do for conversion into decibels because it is so exponential. But also then that makes it even more impressive that the fish is that loud.
Mm-hmm. That's right. It's going to be huge numbers. Yeah.
Extraordinary numbers. So, in fact, Matt, you've often been good about that. There have been times where you've started to do a calculation while we're recording the show, and then you realize it would be a lot of work to do that. And so you say, this would be an excellent extra credit for a grad student.
Yep, that's right. Or like a master's thesis, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, so if you want to write your master's thesis on the drumfish, we suggest an option. Let us know how it turns out. Lars continues, sound is basically waves in air, and shouldn't the same apply to water? The water vibrates and pushes the sound wave to vibrate some kind of listening organ to organs. So the fish could be trained. So the fish could be trained and used for underwater combat.
That was a bit of a jump. Yeah.
Having 1,000 fishes resonating a high-pitched sound would cause havoc in the world of underwater warfare. Indeed. Indeed. Maybe it could be used as a mine-clearing tool. Huh? So I'm glad that Lars finally brought that around to more of a peaceful potential option. And he signs his messages, as always, Space Viking. Thank you, Lars. Thank you, Lars. Thank you for that. So getting to our if of the week, Matt, would you like to lay some groundwork, perhaps? And then we will have to divine the actual words of the incantation, which will bring the thought experiment into fruition.
Well, this is the phase of things where we put our childish obsession with reality to the side and expand our minds to the possibilities of other universes and then decide that we're going to hang out in one of those universes for a little while. It's not always very safe. So in this particular circumstance, your body may be moving in uncontrolled fashion. So I'd suggest strapping yourself in if you can still reach, you know, your AirPods once you're strapped in.
That's right. That's right. As we ask, what the if? The music came blasting in that time. What the if we had no free will? None. Nothing. But that would, everything I'm saying right now has been pre-programmed or predetermined somehow. I don't know what's going on. What the if? Matt, what hath we wrought?
All right, so we're tackling one of the great questions of human thought, and it's often articulated as the free will problem. So you probably made a decision to listen to this podcast right now, right? And it seems to you that you had a choice in that, right? You could have watched television. You could have read a book and bettered yourself. But instead, you chose to listen to us. So the notion of free will is simply that you can choose between those things. You could imagine a universe in which you chose to read a book instead of listening to us right now. And that there's nothing strange about that, right? So we live our lives on that assumption. You choose what to have for dinner, you choose who to marry, and these are things that you have control over, right? So that's our lived experience, you might say. The problem is that sometimes there are things you can learn about the universe that might make you suspicious that perhaps that impression is not quite right. There's lots of different flavors of how to approach this problem. The classical one is the observation that we're all just made of matter, right? You're made of atoms, just tiny. Well, I should say most of us are made of atoms. I can't speak for all of our listeners. And atoms are just little particles of matter, and we know the rules by which particles of matter move around and interact, right? So we might say Newton's laws, right? So a particular particle is moving in a certain direction, and it keeps moving that way until it bounces off another particle. And we can use the laws of physics to calculate exactly how that interaction would happen, right? So you imagine balls on a pool table, right? So if you plan out your shot just right, you can predict exactly where every ball is going to go. So we would say the technical term for this is we say that the game of pool is deterministic.
If you set it up exactly the same way and you hit the cue ball in exactly the same way, you'll get exactly the same results every time. And then closely related to that is the idea of predictability. So even if I don't actually hit the cue ball, if I sort of sit down with my equations and say, if I hit it in this particular way, I know that the three ball is going to go into this pocket. And then if I actually do it, then that actually happens. And I say, yay, I'm so good at physics. So like I said, we say that's deterministic and predictable. Now the problem becomes you are just a fancy group of pool balls, right? The atoms in your body, at least in principle, their motions are predictable in exactly the same way as the motion of the balls on the pool table. So, you know, when you move your thumb to choose the podcasting app, that's the result of a particular series of particles moving in your nervous system. And the motions in that nervous system, you know, began as motions in your brain. So that if I was watching your brain very carefully, I could predict where your thumb was going to go next. So that means in principle, you actually didn't choose anything. It was just the motion of particles that happened to be going in a particular way to make your thumb move over the podcasting app. So the one of the conclusions of this is that free will is an illusion. You're just a collection of particles moving under the impersonal influence of the laws of physics. And the laws of physics don't break. They don't change. So you sort of track it back. You say, okay, well, why were the motions of the particles in my brain in that particular way? And then you say, well, where did the particles in your brain come from? And well, it was from the fish oil you ate last week. So those particles had some particular motion that bounced off other particles already in your body. So you say, well, where did that... the particles in the fish oil come from, and it came from the fish, and the fish ate the algae, and eventually you go back, and there was some particle the moment after the Big Bang that was going in a particular direction and started this whole chain of particles smashing into each other that ended with you choosing to have a Twinkie for dinner instead of a salad.
Yes.
Right? And then you say, and your partner says, why are you eating that? That's terrible. And you say, well, it's not my choice, right? I'm just a deterministic collection of particles, right? I can't choose what it is. There's just something about the history of the universe that resulted in me moving in this particular way.
And the Twinkie defense is a real thing, didn't somebody?
Yeah, the Twinkie
that?
Defense is a real thing. That's right. Yeah, I think it was someone accused of murder who said they've been eating so many Twinkies that they're essentially they had gone insane. Right, they had become ill from eating it. But deterministic. So I should say I just gave kind of the physics version of this too. But you can make deterministic arguments against free will from all sorts of sciences too. So the biology one essentially still reduces to physics. So, you know, neuroscientists say your brain is just electrical charges and particles. But you can also do like psychosocial ones too. So you say someone raised in a violent environment becomes trained to act violently themselves. So they no longer have the argument you can make. Say you no longer have any choice in the sorts of actions you take. Rather, that's determined by your past history and the kind of environment you grew up in. Charles Darrow, the famous 20th century lawyer, tries to make this argument, again, for a murder case in Chicago. Something about Chicago that lends itself to arguments against free will. I don't know what this means. And then, like, say, Freudian psychology, also lends itself to these sorts of actions because, you know, Freud will say, you think you're choosing to marry this particular person because you love them, but he says it's actually because you hate your mother. And that's hidden in your subconscious. And we can explain your actions that seem to be free choice actually as a result of past processes.
Interesting. Yeah. So I think one thing it boils down to is, first of all, let's say this for the thought experiment. I think the thing we're saying is, what if it was proven that we had no free will?
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. What if that was absolutely proven? How might the world be different?
Yeah. And I should say there are neuroscientists that feel they have demonstrated this. They're what are called... Gabby, do you know this? They're not delayed choice experiments.
Quacks? I'm kidding.
Crap, I can't remember the technical term for the kinds of experiments. But what they do is they measure the electrical processes in your nerves and find that the signal moving from your brain to your hand begins before you are aware of it. Right. So they say something like, push this red button, and they can measure that the signal starts before you consciously make the choice, I'm going to push the button. So they say that's clear evidence that your consciousness is wrong about making that choice.
I think Marcus de Sotoy in one of his BBC documentaries goes and has this done to, has a thing put on his head, whatever, where they measure this, measure these signals and show that happening. And he was blown away, how weird that was for someone to say, oh yeah, actually that choice was already made. The idea that the choice is made before you become aware of it is very strange. But let's say it's absolutely proven. I think, what do you think, what if there's a big headline in all the newspapers tomorrow, free will, what would it be? Free will is a lie or a fake
illusion.
Free will disproven. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, free will disproven. I should say we have seen that headline many times over the past couple of millennia.
Really?
People regularly announce that they have disproven free will based on the same kind of arguments
we've been talking about,
right?
The
problem is really a difficult one, because as with our if here, so what are you going to do different once somebody tells you you have no free will? How is your life? What are you going to do different tomorrow now that you know you have no choice over your actions?
So Gabby, you wake up tomorrow and see this headline.
In my head, the thing that I'm thinking of is not necessarily that it changes your decision making so much as it changes your outlook, which then results on changing your decision making. So if you think you have no free will, then nothing matters, right? So for example, I choose to be a nice person because I don't like experiencing the consequences of being a mean person. If you're mean, people don't like to be around you. People are rude to you. People don't like, don't help you out with stuff. You get isolated. Yeah. Those are things I don't like. So I therefore choose, among other things, to be a nice person. If free will doesn't matter, though, and people are going to have whatever reaction to you that they're just pre-programmed to have, you're probably going to put a lot of the stress off of yourself, right? Like, you're not going to beat yourself up, right, for not noticing that old lady struggling with the door, because you're like, well, what does it matter? It's all preordained. This is all supposed to happen.
That's exactly right. It was already decided whether I'm going to help the old lady, so I don't have to choose to.
Yeah, exactly. So I feel like it kind of could create this very, callousness vortex almost. I mean, we live in New York City. It is a very fast pace of people vortex. Don't always care. But I could imagine you getting a fair amount worse, right? Because you don't have to take responsibility for your actions. You just be like, well, I don't have free will.
Yeah, and this is often advanced it's an argument against the claim that we don't have free will. But it's what you might call a consequentialist argument, right? It's not saying the argument is wrong. It's saying that the consequences of it are so terrible that we should not acknowledge it. Because how do you have moral responsibility if you don't get to choose something, right? So you say, I stole this Twinkie. But I didn't choose to, right? I had no control over it. So it doesn't make any sense to punish me for it because I couldn't have not done it. So I think Gabby's right that the daily social interactions are going to get weird fast.
Yeah, I find the thing I find most confusing or troubling is so what goes on in the moment? Let's say I read that headline and I'm like, oh, okay, and then I come back, but and yet I still find myself struggling to choose something. Sure. And like, you know, is it going to be sometimes when I'm so tired in the morning, the mere choice of having to choose which of the say 20 mugs I have, because I love mugs, you know.
Same.
And I love souvenir mugs especially. So I have, oh, well, there's this or there's that, you know. Is it going to be the Pixar mug or is it going to be the Star Wars mug? And that, but I feel that choice very, very strongly. Like I'm actually caught in this choice. Yeah. So if that's not free will, what's going on there?
So this is again one of the great objections is that it doesn't matter what intellectual argument you give me, I still feel like I have free will. And one of the possible responses to that is, sure, but you're wrong, right? People are wrong about all sorts of things.
That's true.
Just because you have an impression of something doesn't make it correct.
Right.
So there's a number of kind of classical responses to this, but probably one of the most common is this this sort of sense that we're just observers, right? We, our consciousness, are trapped in our materialist bodies, and our bodies just do stuff based on the laws of nature, and we make up a story after the fact that we had decided to do those things. But we don't actually have any agency in it. We just feel like we do. And that's...
So we're like trapped on some sort of roller coaster ride.
Yeah, that's right. But then we make up a story about how we're in charge of the roller coaster ride. To make ourselves feel better. Because who wants to be trapped in a deterministic prison, right? That's terrible. Nobody wants that.
Right.
But there, so as I said, we've been talking about kind of the science-y version. There's a theological version too, which is essentially Calvinism, that God has predetermined all the events in the universe. And in particular for Calvinism, the issue is whether you're going to, go to heaven or hell. And you might, most flavors of Christianity say, you know, that's determined by whether you're a good person and what kind of actions you take. But if you live in a predetermined universe, then you can't decide. God has already decided and planned out whether you're going to steal that Twinkie and therefore whether you're going to go to hell. So you might then say, well, why should I be a good person if it's already been decided?
Yeah.
And this becomes this kind of weird reverse paradox where you have to act like a good person to demonstrate that God has decided you're going to be a good person. And then everyone will look at you and say, oh, that's great. It's so nice that you're one of God's chosen. And I can tell you're one of God's chosen because you did not steal that Twinkie when you had the chance.
It's complicated.
It's extremely complicated. Yeah.
I also just really like the idea of like a God being like, oh no, like looking at a baby and being like, oh, straight up, you're going to hell.
Well,
like just planning that arc totally in advance, be like, screw this baby.
It is a little unsettling. And that's literally what you get is that God has decided even before you were born, even before your parents were born, right? In the moment of creation, God planned everything out.
Yeah.
And he's like, Robert Smith, you're going to be an asshole. That's just the way it's going to be.
Well, you can't argue with the roll of a 20-sided die. I mean, whatever it is.
No, that's right. And it would have to be a pretty big die for the whole universe, right? 10 to the 15th sided die.
That would be cool.
So in some sense, we could say the question of how would people act differently if they were told they had no free will is we've actually been running that experiment since John Calvin in the 15th century. I'd have to look up his dates. And I say weirdly, even though sort of I think our initial sense is that determinism gets rid of free will. In fact, Calvinist societies are extremely orderly and calm. So that's like Switzerland, Denmark. And I should say also the pilgrims that come over to the U.S. are Calvinists too. Right. So we have a strong strain of Calvinism in U.S. culture, whether we want to acknowledge it or not.
Yeah. Now, the final thing, what I find the most fun sort of part of this thought experiment is how we hack this. I think that would be the next thing. Be like, okay, we're tired of this predetermined ness that we live in. Could we, and again, you may say, well, people have actually been trying to, so I'm curious, is it possible to hack this so that we can take control again?
Yeah.
Whoever we are, whatever that means.
Right. So it somewhat depends on what flavor of determinism you're using. So if you're using the we're just billiard balls, that's pretty tricky because then you have to kind of make an exception for the laws of physics. And that is, so that's like Descartes' solution, actually, is to say that we have an immaterial soul that can nudge particles to move in slightly different directions than they would otherwise. This gives rise to all sorts of strange metaphysical problems. That's kind of what's called dualism, the idea that there's a material world and there's a spiritual world, and the spiritual world can kind of control the material world. So that gets weird.
Yeah.
So some people hope that, actually, going back to Heisenberg, in the early 20th century, some people hope that quantum mechanics rescues us from this because that allows for kind of statistical randomness. Most physicists are cranky about that because they say that the kind of randomness you get with quantum phenomena is so low that it's not low in the kind of metaphysical sense, that it's not likely to actually provide consciousness or the ability for consciousness to affect the material world. But that's still up in the air, I should say. You can still make good arguments for quantum free will.
Right. Because it only makes a difference at the scale of subatomic particles.
Yeah, that's right. And we say that you are not on the scale of subatomic particles, right?
Right.
So you have to come up with kind of crazy solution to this.
What about, can it be D&D to the rescue? Can I just say, I'm actually going to decide the next decision I make, and there's which mug I'm going to have. Is it going to be the Pixar mug or the Star Wars mug? Mm-hmm. It's going to be based on the roll of a 20-sided die.
Oh, yeah, that's right. So because dice are our go-to for randomness, right? But they're actually they're not random in any deep sense. The physics of which side of a die is going to come up top is perfectly deterministic and clear. You just don't know it, right? You're not good enough at physics to calculate that ahead of time. So that's just ignorance, right? It feels random to us because we don't know the forces at play. But in fact, there's no randomness in the fall of a die.
So the predetermined outcome of the die roll has already, the outcome of the die roll has already been determined as well.
That's right. At the beginning of the universe. Yes. According to this kind of reasoning. Mm-hmm. Gabby, you were about to say something.
Yeah, no. And I was going to just mention that, like, randomness in general, so my first thought was, inject some measure of randomness in the billiard ball idea where everything has been determined since the Big Bang. Yeah. But there's nothing that's going to ever be random then. But randomness is actually like a problem, even in like computer science. Like if you ask a computer for a random number, it's not actually random. It's sort of like a pseudo random process that generates what seems to you like a random number. But much like Matt said, you just don't know the math behind it. And your ability to sort of predict it based on what you have is going to be low. But it's not actually random. It's not just like, you know, pulling a number out of thin air. There's sort of a calculation that I think partially uses like the date and time the computer.
Yeah, there's a whole field of trying to calculate genuinely random numbers, and it's always a fake in some way. You just have to decide what kind of pseudo randomness are you actually interested in, because like for most purposes the roll of a die works pretty well. Like you said, it feels like you're not having to choose which mug to use, but a clever person will know which mug you're going to use because they're really good at physics, and then they can poison you, right? So beware. Don't let physicists into your house is the answer. Yeah.
This is why when Sean Carroll, who we had on the show once before, you'll remember, when he needs a random choice made, he has an app. I don't think he made it. There's an app you can get that is connected to CERN, to the Large Hadron Collider or something like
oh,
this.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
That basically watches, I don't know, what is it? Watches some sort of subatomic interaction.
Yeah, it's a quantum process. So you could make the argument that is as random as it is possible to be, in the sense that you can't predict which way it's going to be. So that would be handy, actually. So if you are trying to decide which mug to use, who to marry, you can rely on CERN to help with that.
Yeah. So wrapping up, if we were to imagine hacking it to the point where you actually could have free will, what might that look like? And what would happen? You know, there's the first person ever to be able to do that. Let's say through some sort of, I don't know, neurological process.
Well, so let's hear. So we don't. So one solution to feeling like you live in a deterministic universe is Sean's solution, which is to have some genuinely random process and base your actions on that. But that's but I don't think anybody wants to base their life on genuinely random processes, right? That would be that would be weird. I don't think anybody wants to actually live a genuinely random life. So when we say I have free will or I have control over myself, we mean something, I don't know, in between those two things. We want our life to be deterministic, but determined by our choices. And of course, our choices are determined by other things, right? If I've never had a Twinkie before, that will change whether I choose to have that for dinner.
Yep.
So even what we think of as genuinely free will things are perhaps not quite so.
But if you were to, I think there'd be, if you had lived through the era where we all absolutely believed that we had no free will, which would be interesting. So we, for some reason, had a global Calvinist society. And then you suddenly absolutely had proven, had discovered a provable way so that you genuinely were making a free will choice for the first time. That would be very daunting. I'd feel very...
you feel some pressure?
Nervous about making the wrong choice, which is what we experience anyway.
I think it's very funny framing it like that too, because say you finally have like the key unlocked in your brain, so you have free will now, right? But you're left with this like a crisis of imagination. Like, what can you do now that you have free will? That's so different from what you were going to do before. Like, now you can know you're choosing that mug of your own volition. You still just chose a mug. Like, it's a lot of pressure to perform, I guess, if you're the first person who sort of gets that switch thrown.
So I don't know. Maybe that means everyone just sits at home and just follows Spotify's autoplay so they don't have to make any decisions for the rest of the day. Which is not so bad, right?
That's pretty much, I think that's what's happening with TikTok. And
oh, well, I guess that's right, actually. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that.
We're just following the whims of the algorithm. Yeah. So Gabby, if you, if you lived in this this world where free will was absolutely proven to not exist, what would be your takeaway?
I'd hate it. I think the whole thing is that I wouldn't have a takeaway, right? If I lived in a world where free will didn't exist, there's nothing I could glean from that, nor is there any sort of point for me gleaning anything about it. I have no clear ability to functionally understand the universe beside myself, like beyond myself, and any attempt to do anything about it is already preordained. Such is the catch-22.
Yeah, that's right. So do you just stay at home?
Maybe. Yeah, you know what? Honestly, maybe I just kind of give less of a crap. Like, it is tremendously energy taxing to care all the time. And yeah, it would be nice to sort of have the justification for an iteration of myself where I just sort of become a scumbag and like don't have to care about things. So maybe that's what happens to me in a society where there's just it's proven that there's no free will.
That's interesting. I can, it strikes me that the word when I said the word algorithm recently, it's a little bit like that. It's like we're just, there's some algorithm that's running our mind, you know, and you just sort of give yourself up to the algorithm.
Mm-hmm. And as with social media, you feel like you're choosing, you know, who to follow and what to see, but in fact, the algorithm is feeding it all to you. So the neuroscientists say your brain is just like that. Right, you feel like you're in charge, but in fact, the neural algorithms are deciding what you're going to do and see.
Well, I always think that's funny because what part of you is separable from your brain?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like,
No, that's exactly right. And that's why Cartesian dualism doesn't work, essentially, is that there's no clean answer to that question. But then what it still comes down to is our lived experience feels so different than the intellectual conclusion we come to. When you really dig through these things, it's hard to know how to reconcile those.
Yeah. Fascinating. Fascinating. Ultimately, somebody would figure out how to abscond. Well, maybe this is what social engineering is all about. Anyway, basically, other people do abscond with our algorithms or learn to influence our algorithms, and that's how we dress. That's why we dress the way we dress and listen to what we listen to. So, very cool. Very cool. Well, thank you, Matt. Thank you for this journey down the world of no free will whatsoever.
I didn't have any choice in bringing it to you. So.
And thank you to the algorithms of all our listeners that dragged you here unwittingly to listen to this show. Gabby, congratulations on getting a PhD and entering this new world. Whoop. Or congratulations to your algorithm or your atoms that led you to get a PhD. That was good choice on their part.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a great job in continually shuffling me towards that contrived success.
Very good.
Is there anything you want to plug, Gabby? Dr. Gabby.
Yeah, I guess I'll still throw out a plug for the anthology. I have some stuff that's going to be appearing in. It's not going to be out until, I think, sometime around November, but the anthology is called The Map of Lost Places. It is a horror anthology that I have a sci-fi horror piece in. So far it's still in just like pre-order stage. But I'll tell y'all when it's like actually ready.
All right. Cool. Very cool. Matt, anything you want to plug?
A reminder to my students that their final projects are due on May 13th. I don't know if that counts as a plug or not. I'm teaching a summer class. If you want to take that, register for it soon. So we'll see.
Wonderful. And what's the subject of the class?
It's called Seen and Unseen in Science, and it's about how scientists use visual reasoning and also how they talk about things they can't see. So it's how our visual thinking enters into science.
Oh,
it's a fun
cool.
class.
Yeah,
that is amazing. Cool. And I'm literally, that is a thought on my mind right now because I have to give a present. A friend of mine cajoled me into doing career day at his school. And I have to give a presentation to a bunch of children about what I do. And what I do is essentially what it looks like is I move clear liquids around for 8 hours a day and then I go home. So I'm like, I don't know how to explain what I do to children.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome.
That's a great distillation, so to speak. Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, but that's a great job. I would take that job. Mm-hmm. Gabby, would you lead us through the closing ceremonies and help us get this universe back in order?
Yeah. So as we are staring, paralyzed with indecision or nay, prefixed decision at our rack of mugs in the morning, we flick our randomness switch on the side of our head and elect just to smash the whole cabinet as we scream...
Thank you, Gabby. Thank you, Matt. Thank you, Patreon supporters. We thank every one of you for your devotion and your support. If you're a Patreon supporter, you're going to get bonus content just for you. If you don't know what that is and you're not a Patreon supporter, go to patreon.com/whattheif and find out more. And we salute you, and no matter where you are in the world, including Sweden, where Lars resides, Space Viking, a shout out to you, and we'll see you all next week.